Welcome back, everyone, to 1001 Stories for the Road and Agatha Christie's The Mystery of the Blue Train. Today, chapters 29 and 30. And now, chapter 29, A Letter from Home. It reads, "Dear Catherine, living among grand friends as you are doing now, I don't suppose you will care to hear any of our news. But as I always thought you were a sensible girl, perhaps you are a trifle less swollen-headed than I suppose. Everything goes on much the same here. There was great trouble about the new curate, who is scandalously high. In my view, he is neither more nor less than a Roman. Everybody has spoken to the vicar about it. But you know what the vicar is, all Christian charity and no proper spirit. I have had a lot of trouble with maids lately. That girl Annie was no good, skirts up to her knees and wouldn't wear sensible woolen stockings. Not one of them can bear being spoken to. I have had a lot of pain with my rheumatism one way or another, and Dr. Harris persuaded me to go and see a London specialist, a waste of 3 guineas and a railway fare, as I told him, but by waiting until Wednesday I managed to get a cheap return. The London doctor pulled a long face and talked all round about and never straight out until I said to him, 'I'm a plain woman, doctor, and I like things to be plainly stated. Is it cancer, or is it not?' And then, of course, he had to say, 'It was.' They say, 1 year with care, and not too much pain, though I am sure I can bear pain as well as any other Christian woman. Life seems rather lonely at times, with most of my friends dead or gone before. I wish you were in St. Mary Mead, my dear, and that is a fact. If you hadn't come into this money and gone off into grand society, I would have offered you double the salary poor Jane gave you to come and look after me. But there's no good wanting what we can't get. However, if things should go ill with you, and that is always possible, I have heard no end tales of bogus noblemen marrying girls and getting hold of their money and then leaving them at the church door. I dare say you are too sensible for anything of the kind to happen to you, but one never knows. And never having had much attention of any kind, it might easily go to your head now. So just in case, my dear, remember there is always a home for you here, and though a plain-spoken woman, I am a warm-hearted one, too. Your affectionate old friend, Amelia Viner. P.S. I saw a mention of you in the paper with your cousin, Viscountess Tamplin, and I cut it out and put it with my cuttings. I prayed for you on Sunday that you might be kept from pride and vainglory." Catherine read this characteristic epistle through twice. Then she laid it down and stared out of her bedroom window across the blue waters of the Mediterranean. She felt a curious lump in her throat. A sudden wave of longing for St. Mary Mead swept over her. So full of familiar, everyday, stupid little things, and yet, home. She felt very inclined to lay her head down on her arms and indulge in a real good cry. Lennox, coming in at the moment, saved her. "Hello, Catherine," said Lennox. "I say, what is the matter?" "Nothing," said Catherine, grabbing up Miss Viner's letter and thrusting it into her handbag. "You looked rather queer," said Lennox. "I say, I hope you don't mind. I rang up your detective friend, Monsieur Poirot, and asked him to lunch with us in Nice. I said you wanted to see him, as I thought he might not come for me." "Did you want to see him, then?" asked Catherine. "Yes," said Lennox. "I rather lost my heart to him. I never met a man before whose eyes were really green like a cat's." "All right," said Catherine. She spoke listlessly. The last few days had been trying. Derek Kettering's arrest had been the topic of the hour, and the blue train mystery had been thrashed out from every conceivable standpoint. "I've ordered the car," said Lennox. "And I've told Mother some lie or other. Unfortunately, I can't remember exactly what. But it won't matter, as she never remembers. If she knew where we were going, she would want to come, too, to pump Monsieur Poirot." The girls arrived at the Negresco to find Poirot waiting. He was full of Gaelic politeness, and showered so many compliments upon the two girls that they were soon helpless with laughter. Yet for all that, the meal was not a gay one. Catherine was dreamy and distracted, and Lennox made bursts of conversation, interspersed by silences. As they were sitting on the terrace sipping their coffee, she suddenly attacked Poirot bluntly. "How are things going? You know what I mean." Poirot shrugged his shoulders.
"They take their course," he said.
"And you are just letting them take their course?" He looked at Lennox a little sadly.
"You are young, mademoiselle, but there are three things that cannot be hurried. Le bon Dieu, nature, and old people."
"Nonsense," said Lennox. "You're not old."
"Ah, it is pretty what you say there."
"Here's Major Knighton," said Lennox. Catherine looked round quickly and then turned back again. "He's with Mr. Van Alden," continued Lennox. "There's something I want to ask Major Knighton about. I won't be a minute." Left alone together, Poirot bent forward and murmured to Catherine,
"You are distrait, mademoiselle. Your thoughts, they are far away, are they not?"
"Just as far as England, no farther." Guided by a sudden impulse, she took the letter she had received that morning and handed it across to him to read. "That is the first word that has come to me from my old life. Somehow or other, it hurts." He read through and then handed it back to her.
"So you are going back to St. Mary Mead?" he said slowly.
"No, I'm not," said Catherine. "Why should I?"
"Ah," said Poirot, "it is my mistake. You will excuse me one little minute."
He strolled across to where Lennox Tamplin was talking to Van Alden and Knighton. The American looked old and haggard. He greeted Poirot with a curt nod, but without any other sign of animation. As he turned to reply to some observation made by Lennox, Poirot drew Knighton aside.
"Mr. Van Alden looks ill," he said.
"Do you wonder?" asked Knighton. "The scandal of Dirk Kettering's arrest has about put the lid on things, as far as he is concerned. He's even regretting that he asked you to find out the truth."
"He should go back to England," said Poirot.
"We are going the day after tomorrow."
"That is good news," said Poirot.
He hesitated and looked across the terrace to where Catherine was sitting.
"I wish," he murmured, "that you could tell Miss Gray that."
"Tell her what?"
"That you, I mean Mr. Van Alden, is returning to England."
Knighton looked a little puzzled, but he readily crossed the terrace and joined Catherine. Poirot saw him go with a satisfied nod of the head, and then joined Lennox and the American. After a minute or two, they joined the others. Conversation was general for a few minutes. Then the millionaire and his secretary departed. Poirot also prepared to take his departure.
"A thousand thanks for your hospitality, mesdemoiselles," he cried. "It has been a most charming luncheon. Ma foi, I needed it."
He swelled out his chest and thumped it.
"I am now a lion, a giant. Ah, Mademoiselle Catherine, you have not seen me as I can be. You have seen the gentle, the calm Hercule Poirot, but there is another Hercule Poirot. I go now to bully, to threaten, to strike terror into the hearts of those who listen to me."
He looked at them in a self-satisfied way, and they both appeared to be duly impressed, though Lennox was biting her underlip, and the corners of Catherine's mouth had a suspicious twitch.
"And I shall do it," he said gravely. "Oh, yes, I shall succeed."
He had gone but a few steps when Catherine's voice made him turn.
"Monsieur Poirot, I want to tell you that I think you were right in what you said. I am going back to England, almost immediately."
Poirot stared at her very hard, and under the directness of his scrutiny, she blushed.
"I see," he said gravely.
"I don't believe you do," said Catherine.
"I know more than you think, mademoiselle,"
he said quietly. He left her with an odd little smile upon his lips. Entering a waiting car, he drove to Antibes. Hippolyte,
the Comte de la Roche's wooden-faced manservant was busy at the Villa Marina polishing his master's beautiful cut table glass. The Comte de la Roche himself had gone to Monte Carlo for the day. Chancing to look out of the window, Hippolyte espied a visitor walking briskly up to the hall door, a visitor of so uncommon a type that Hippolyte, experienced as he was, had some difficulty in placing him. Calling to his wife, Marie, who was busy in the kitchen, he drew her attention to what he called a strange type.
"It is not the police again?"
said Marie anxiously.
"Look for yourself," said Hippolyte.
Marie looked.
"Certainly not the police," she declared. "I'm glad."
"They have not really worried us much," said Hippolyte. "In fact, but for Monsieur le Comte's warning, I should never have guessed that stranger at the wine shop to be what he was."
The hall bell pealed, and Hippolyte, in a grave and decorous manner, went to open the door.
"Monsieur le Comte, I regret to say, is not at home."
The little man with the large mustaches beamed placidly.
"I know that," he replied. "You are Hippolyte Flavel, are you not?"
"Yes, monsieur, that is my name."
"And you have a wife, Marie Flavel."
"Yes, monsieur, but—"
"I desire to see you both," said the stranger, and he stepped nimbly past Hippolyte into the hall.
"Your wife is doubtless in the kitchen," he said. "I will go there."
Before Hippolyte could recover his breath, the other had selected the right door at the back of the hall and passed along the passage and into the kitchen, where Marie paused open-mouthed to stare at him.
"Voilà," said the stranger, and sank into a wooden armchair. "I am Hercule Poirot."
"Yes, monsieur."
"You do not know the name?"
"I have never heard it," said Hippolyte.
"Permit me to say that you have been badly educated. It is the name of one of the great ones of this world."
He sighed and folded his hands across his chest. Hippolyte and Marie were staring at him uneasily. They were at a loss what to make of this unexpected and extremely strange visitor.
"Monsieur desires," murmured Hippolyte mechanically, "I desire to know why you have lied to the police."
"Monsieur," cried Hippolyte, "I lied to the police? Never have I done such a thing."
Monsieur Poirot shook his head. "You are wrong," he said. "You have done it on several occasions. Let me see."
He took a small notebook from his pocket and consulted it.
"Ah, yes, on 7 occasions at least. I will recite them to you."
In a gentle, unemotional voice, he proceeded to outline the 7 occasions. Hippolyte was taken aback.
"But it is not of these past lapses that I wish to speak," continued Poirot. "Only, my dear friend, do not get into the habit of thinking yourself too clever. I come now to the particular lie in which I am concerned. Your statement that the Comte de la Roche arrived at this villa on the morning of 14th January."
"But that was no lie, monsieur. That was the truth. Monsieur le Comte arrived here on the morning of Tuesday the 14th. That is so, Marie, is it not?"
Marie assented eagerly.
"Ah, yes, that is quite right. I remember it perfectly."
"Ah," said Poirot, "and what did you give your good master for déjeuner that day?"
"I—"
Marie paused, trying to collect herself.
"Odd," said Poirot, "how one remembers some things and forgets others."
He leaned forward and struck the table a blow with his fist. His eyes flashed with anger.
"Yes, yes, it is as I say. You tell your lies, and you think nobody knows. But there are 2 people who knew. Yes, 2 people. One is le bon Dieu."
He raised a hand to heaven, and then settling himself back in his chair and shutting his eyelids, he murmured comfortably, "And the other is Hercule Poirot."
"I assure you, monsieur, you are completely mistaken. Monsieur le Comte left Paris on Monday night."
"True," said Poirot, "by the Rapide. I do not know where he broke his journey. Perhaps you do not know that.
What I do know is that he arrived here on Wednesday morning, and not on Tuesday morning.
Monsieur is mistaken, said Marie, stolidly.
Poirot rose to his feet.
Then the law must take its course, he murmured. A pity.
What do you mean, monsieur? Asked Marie, with a shade of uneasiness.
You'll be arrested and held as accomplices concerned in the murder of Mrs. Catherine, the English lady who was killed.
Murder?
The man's face had gone chalk white, his knees knocked together. Marie dropped the rolling pin and began to weep.
But it is impossible. Impossible. I thought...
Since you stick to your story, there is nothing to be said. I think you are both foolish.
He was turning towards the door when an agitated voice arrested him.
Monsieur, monsieur, just a little moment. I had no idea there was anything of this kind. I thought it was just a matter concerning a lady. There have been little awkwardnesses with the police over ladies before. But murder, that is very different.
I have no patience with you, cried Poirot.
He turned round on them and angrily shook his fist in Hippolyte's face.
Am I to stop here all day, arguing with a couple of imbeciles thus? It is the truth I want. If you will not give it to me, that is your lookout. For the last time, when did Monsieur le Comte arrive at the Villa Marina? Tuesday morning or Wednesday morning?
Wednesday,
gasped the man, and behind him, Marie nodded confirmation. Poirot regarded them for a minute or two, then inclined his head gravely.
You are wise, my children,
he said quietly.
Very nearly you are in serious trouble.
He left the Villa Marina, smiling to himself.
One guess confirmed,
he murmured to himself.
Shall I take a chance on the other?
It was 6 o'clock when the card of Monsieur Hercule Poirot was brought up to Morel. She stared at it for a moment or two, and then nodded. When Poirot entered, he found her walking up and down the room feverishly. She turned on him furiously.
Well? She cried. Well, what is it now? Have you not tortured me enough, all of you? Have you not made me betray my poor Derek? What more do you want? Just one little question, mademoiselle. After the train left Lyon, when you entered Mrs. Catherine's compartment.
What?
Poirot looked at her with an air of mild reproach and began again.
I said, when you entered Mrs. Catherine's compartment.
I never did.
And found her.
I never did.
Ah, sacre!
He turned on her in a rage and shouted at her, so that she cowered back before him.
Will you lie to me? I tell you I know what happened as well as though I had been there. You went into her compartment, and you found her dead. I tell you I know it. To lie to me is dangerous. Be careful, Mademoiselle Morel.
Her eyes wavered beneath his gaze and fell.
I didn't.
She began uncertainly, and then stopped.
There is only one thing about which I wonder, said Poirot. I wonder, mademoiselle, if you found what you were looking for, or whether...
Whether what?
Or whether someone else had been before you.
I will answer no more questions,
screamed the dancer. She tore herself away from Poirot's restraining hand, and flinging herself down on the floor in a frenzy, she screamed and sobbed. A frightened maid came rushing in. Hercule Poirot shrugged his shoulders, raised his eyebrows, and quietly left the room. But he seemed satisfied. We'll return with The Mystery of the Blue Train by Agatha Christie and Chapter 30 right after these sponsor messages. And now Chapter 30, Miss Viner Gives Judgment. Catherine looked out of Miss Viner's bedroom window. It was not raining. It was raining, not violently, but with a quiet, well-bred persistence. The window looked out on a strip of front garden with a path down to the gate and neat little flower beds on either side, where later roses and pinks and blue hyacinth would bloom. Miss Viner was lying in a large Victorian bedstead.
A tray with the remains of breakfast had been pushed to one side, and she was busy opening her correspondence and making various caustic comments upon it. Catherine had an open letter in her hand and was reading it through for the second time. It was dated from the Ritz Hotel, Paris. "Cher Mademoiselle Catherine," it began, "I trust that you are in good health and that the return to the English winter has not proved too depressing. Me, I prosecute my inquiries with the utmost diligence. Do not think that it is the holiday that I take here. Very shortly I shall be in England, and I hope then to have the pleasure of meeting you once more. It shall be so, shall it not? On arrival in London, I shall write to you. You remember that we are the colleagues in this affair? But indeed, I think you know that very well. Be assured, mademoiselle, of my most respectful and devoted sentiments. Hercule Poirot." Catherine frowned slightly. It was as though something in the letter puzzled and intrigued her. "A choir boy's picnic, indeed," came from Miss Viner. "Tommy Saunders and Albert Dykes ought to be left behind, and I shan't subscribe to it unless they are. What those two boys think they are doing in church on Sundays? I don't know. Tommy sang, 'O God, make speed to save us,' and never opened his lips again. And if Albert Dykes wasn't sucking a mint humbug, my nose is not what it is and always has been." "I know. They're awful," agreed Catherine. She opened her second letter, and a sudden flush came to her cheeks. Miss Viner's voice in the room seemed to recede into the far distance. When she came back to a sense of her surroundings, Miss Viner was bringing a long speech to a triumphant termination. "And I said to her, 'Not at all. As it happens, Miss Gray is Lady Templin's own cousin. What do you think of that?' 'Were you fighting my battles for me? That was very sweet of you.' 'You can put it that way if you like. There is nothing to me in a title. Vicar's wife or no vicar's wife, that woman is a cat. Hinting you had bought your way into society.' 'Perhaps she was not so very wrong.' 'And look at you,' continued Miss Viner. 'Have you come back a stuck-up fine lady, as well as you might have done? No, there you are, as sensible as you ever were, with a pair of good bell-bringing stockings on and sensible shoes. I spoke to Ellen about it only yesterday. Ellen, I said, you look at Miss Gray. She has been hobnobbing with some of the greatest in the land. And does she go about as you do, with skirts up to her knees and silk stockings that ladder when you look at them, and the most ridiculous shoes that I ever set eyes on?'" Catherine smiled a little to herself. It had apparently been worthwhile to conform to Miss Viner's prejudices. The old lady went on with increasing gusto. "It has been a great relief to me that you have not had your head turned. Only the other day I was looking for my cuttings. I have several about Lady Templin and her war hospital and what not, but I cannot lay my hand upon them. I wish you would look, my dear. Your eyesight is better than mine. They are all in a box in the bureau drawer." Catherine glanced down at the letter in her hand and was about to speak, but checked herself, and going over to the bureau found the box of cuttings and began to look over them. Since her return to St. Mary Mead, her heart had gone out to Miss Viner in admiration of the old woman's stoicism and pluck. She felt that there was little she could do for her old friend, but she knew from experience how much these seemingly small trifles meant to old people. "Here is one," she said presently. "Viscountess Templin, who is running her villa at Nice as an officer's hospital, has just been the victim of a sensational robbery, her jewels having been stolen. Amongst them were some very famous emeralds, heirlooms of the Templin family." "Probably paste," said Miss Viner. "A lot of these society women's jewels are." "Here is another," said Catherine. "A picture of her. A charming camera study of Viscountess Templin with her little daughter Lennox." "Let me look," said Miss Viner. "You can't see much of the child's face, can you? But I dare say that is just as well. Things go by contraries in this world, and beautiful mothers have hideous children. I dare say the photographer realized that to take the back of the child's head was the best thing he could do for her." Catherine laughed. "One of the smartest hostesses on the Riviera this season is Viscountess Templin, who has a villa at Cap Martin. Her cousin, Miss Gray, who recently inherited a vast fortune in a most romantic manner, is staying with her there."
"That is the one I wanted," said Miss Viner. "I expect there has been a picture of you in one of the papers that I have missed. You know the kind of thing. Mrs. Somebody or Other Jones Williams, at the something or other point to point, usually carrying a shooting stick and having one foot lifted up in the air. It must be a trial to some of them to see what they look like."
Catherine did not answer. She was smoothing out the cutting with her finger, and her face had a puzzled, worried look. Then she drew the second letter out of its envelope and mastered its contents once more. She turned to her friend.
"Miss Viner, I wonder. There is a friend of mine, someone I met on the Riviera, who wants very much to come down and see me here."
"A man?" said Miss Viner.
"Yes.
Who is he?"
"He is secretary to Mr. Van Alden, the American millionaire."
"What is his name?"
"Knighton, Major Knighton."
"Secretary to a millionaire, and wants to come down here. Now, Catherine, I'm going to say something to you for your own good. You are a nice girl and a sensible girl, and though you've had your head screwed on the right way for about most things, every woman makes a fool of herself once in her life. 10 to 1 what this man is after is your money."
With a gesture, she arrested Catherine's reply.
"I have been waiting for something of this kind. What is a secretary to a millionaire? 9 times out of 10, it is a young man who likes living soft. A young man with nice manners and a taste for luxury and no brains and no enterprise. And if there's anything that is a softer job than being a secretary to a millionaire, it is marrying a rich woman for her money. I am not saying that you might not be some man's fancy, but you are not young, and though you have a very good complexion, you are not a beauty. And what I say to you is, don't make a fool of yourself. But if you are determined to do so, do see that your money is properly tied up on yourself. There, now I'm finished. What have you got to say?"
"Nothing," said Catherine. "But would you mind if he did come to see me?"
"I wash my hands of it," said Miss Viner. "I have done my duty, and whatever happens now is on your own head. Would you like him to lunch or to dinner?"
"I dare say Ellen could manage dinner, that is, if she didn't lose her head."
"Lunch would be very nice," said Catherine. "It is awfully kind of you, Miss Viner. He asked me to ring him up, so I will do so, and say that we shall be pleased if he will lunch with us. He will motor down from town."
"Ellen does a steak with grilled tomatoes pretty fairly," said Miss Viner. "She doesn't do it well, but she does it better than anything else. It is no good having a tart, because she is heavy-handed with pastry. But her little castle puddings are not bad, and I dare say you could find a nice piece of Stilton at Abbott's. I've always heard that gentlemen like a nice piece of Stilton, and there's a good deal of father's wine left, a bottle of sparkling Moselle, perhaps."
"Oh, no, Miss Viner, that is really not necessary."
"Nonsense, my child. No gentleman is happy unless he drinks something with his meal. There is some good pre-war whiskey, if you think you would prefer that. Now do as I say, and don't argue. The key of the wine cellar is in the third drawer down in the dressing table, in the second pair of stockings on the left-hand side." Catherine went obediently to the spot indicated. "The second pair, now mind," said Miss Viner. "The first pair has my diamond earrings and my filigree brooch in it."
"Oh," said Catherine, rather taken aback.
"Wouldn't you like them put in your jewel case?"
Miss Viner gave vent to a terrific and prolonged snort.
"No, indeed. I have too much sense for that sort of thing, thank you. Dear, dear, I well remember how my poor father had a safe built in downstairs. Pleased as punch he was with it, and he said to my mother, 'Now, Mary, you bring me your jewels in their case every night, and I will lock them away for you.' My mother was a very tactful woman, and she knew the gentlemen like having their own way, and she brought in the jewel case, locked up, just as he said. And one night, burglars broke in, and of course, naturally, the first thing they went for was the safe. It would be, with my father talking up and down the village and bragging about it until you might have thought he kept all King Solomon's diamonds there. They made a clean sweep, got the tankards, the silver cups,
and the presentation gold plate that my father had presented to him, and the jewel case. She sighed reminiscently. My father was in a great state over my mother's jewels. There was the Venetian set, and some very fine cameos, and some pale pink corals, and two diamond rings with quite large stones in them. Then, of course, she had to tell him that, being a sensible woman, she had kept her jewelry rolled up in a pair of corsets. And there it was, still as safe as anything.
And the jewel case had been quite empty?
Oh, no, dear, said Miss Viner. It would have been too light a weight then. My mother was a very intelligent woman. She saw to that. She kept her buttons in the jewel case, and a very handy place it was. Boot buttons in the top tray, trouser buttons in the second tray, and assorted buttons below. Curiously enough, my father was quite annoyed with her. He said he didn't like deceit. But I mustn't go chattering on. You want to go and ring up your friend. And mind you, choose a nice piece of steak, and tell Ellen she is not to have holes in her stockings when she waits at lunch.
Is her name Ellen or Helen, Miss Viner? I thought...
Miss Viner closed her eyes.
I can sound my H's, dear, as well as anyone, but Helen is not a suitable name for a servant. I don't know what the mothers in the lower classes are coming to nowadays.
The rain had cleared away when Knighton arrived at the cottage. The pale, fitful sunshine shone down on it and burnished Catherine's head as she stood in the doorway to welcome him. He came up to her quickly, almost boyishly.
I say, I hope you don't mind. I simply had to see you again soon. I hope the friend you are staying with does not mind.
Come in and make friends with her, said Catherine. She can be most alarming, but you will soon find that she has the softest heart in the world. Miss Viner was enthroned majestically in the drawing-room, wearing a complete set of the cameos which had been so providentially preserved in the family. She greeted Knighton with dignity and an austere politeness which would have damped many men. Knighton, however, had a charm of manner which was not easily set aside, and after about 10 minutes Miss Viner thawed perceptibly. Luncheon was a merry meal, and Ellen, or Helen, in a new pair of silk stockings devoid of ladders, performed prodigies of waiting. Afterwards, Catherine and Knighton went for a walk, and they came back to have a tea, tête-à-tête, since Miss Viner had gone to lie down. When the car had finally driven off, Catherine went slowly upstairs. A voice called her, and she went into Miss Viner's bedroom.
"Friend gone?"
"Yes, thank you very much for letting me ask him down."
"No need to thank me. Do you think I am the sort of old curmudgeon who will never do anything for anybody?"
"I think you are a dear," said Catherine, affectionately.
"Phumph,"
said Miss Viner, mollified. As Catherine was leaving the room, she called her back.
"Catherine?"
"Yes?"
"I was wrong about that young man of yours. A man, when he is making up to anybody, can be cordial and gallant, and full of little attentions and altogether charming. But when a man is really in love, he can't help looking like a sheep. Now, whenever that young man looked at you, he looked like a sheep. I take back all I said this morning. It is genuine."
We hope you enjoyed these two chapters of The Blue Mystery Train by Agatha Christie. I'll mention again that I did see The Blue Mystery Train. I think it was Poirot Season 10. I'm not sure which episode in Season 10 it was. Other than the fact that the murder took place on a train, the script was totally different than what we've been sharing here in the book. Even if you thought you might take a peek and try and get ahead of the story, you won't be getting ahead. The story is absolutely opposite. The only value I could find in it was just being able to picture the characters. Just thought I'd share that with you. I'm enjoying this story very much. I think Agatha Christie is just a terrific writer, and I can see why she has such a huge fan club. Thanks for joining us. We always appreciate our Patreon supporters, by the way, who, for about the cost of a cup of blended coffee, help to support our basic expenses here at 1001 Stories Network. If you'd like to check out ways to support us, that's the best way at Patreon, patreon.com/1001 Stories Network. Give it a try and make a monthly pledge to us.
You're supporting some great literature here at 1001 Stories Network. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back next week with chapters 31 and 32 as we approach the really suspenseful ending of The Mystery of the Blue Train by Agatha Christie. This is your host and storyteller, John Hagedorn. This is 1001 Stories for the Road, and we'll be back soon.